Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California radio show, America's longest-running radio program. I'm Gloria Duffy, co-president and co-CEO of the club, a nonpartisan, nonprofit public forum that's been presenting a wide range of thought leaders on important issues of the day for 120 years. Somewhere in the midst of a pandemic, economic upheaval, and social turmoil, optimism seemed to fall out of favor in this country. Is there a way back? Chris Anderson thinks he has a way. Anderson, curator of the popular TED Talks and a best-selling author, has been looking into how we can supercharge the human impulse of generosity and in the process build a more hopeful future. He asks, what if generosity could become infectious generosity? Today's program was made possible by the generous support of the Long Now Foundation, with additional support from the Ken and Jacqueline Broad Family Fund. To ask Anderson about his ideas, we turn to DJ Patil, the former U.S. Chief Data Scientist and currently General Partner at Great Point Ventures. He's also a member of the Commonwealth Club World Affairs Board of Governors. Here's their conversation.
All right.
I am delighted to be here with Chris Anderson to discuss his latest book, Infectious Generosity, The Ultimate Idea Worth Spreading. And Chris, this book is phenomenal. Thank you for writing it, first of all, because I have lots of takeaways. But I think we should just start with the premise of the book and why spend your time writing this book.
Thank you, DJ. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Ken. Thank you, everyone. It's so great to be back in San Fran, familiar faces and friends. It's very moving, actually. I got depressed. I got so glum at how my techno-optimism of the 90s and early aughts had kind of been crushed by a decade of disappointment online. Like, social media was supposed to be the thing that connected the world, and there was so much possibility there. And instead, the world seems to be getting meaner, and we all know different versions of this story. I can't stand it. I think it's really dangerous. I think if we don't do something about it, we won't be able to solve anything else, because we are in danger of giving up humanity's superpower, which is to cooperate. We're poisoning each other with disaffection, disgust, hatred, outrage, etc. So is there anything that could be done about it? And this book is a hopeful, determined, possibly desperate, you will be the judge, attempt to find a pathway that can fight that and find a different way.
Let's dig into that a little bit more, because the two words, infectious generosity, are two very interesting choices of words. You know, infectious implying the viral aspect of things, but generosity is also a strange concept in some ways.
So it is. It is. It's kind of a boring word in itself, like it's a Sunday school word. And the question is, so what hit me was this. So I started thinking about this seriously during the pandemic. And pandemic, you've got this tiny little invisible virus. It's nothing. It's a few atoms. You change the shape of it, and it changed the world. It shut down the world economy. So you don't have to be big to be powerful, just infectious. And the mathematics of infectiousness is incredible. Something can have not much effect at all. Like, imagine a beautiful story, for example. Can you make a beautiful story infectious? Well, you make it a bit more beautiful, and a few more people hear about it. If you can get it so that 10 people will pass it along to 11 people, suddenly that story reaches millions in time. So what does it take to allow generosity, and if you like, stories of generosity, to go viral? Because if we can do that, we will change how we think about each other.
Well, you've helped create one of the most viral platforms out there. If we asked everyone out there to raise their hand if they've shared a TED Talk, it's definitely 100%. And so
if only out of embarrassment for being shown up.
Well, it's such a phenomenal, like, the content that you provided is such a phenomenal gift. And we'll get into that a little bit in a minute. But if we're sticking on that COVID analogy, since COVID turned us all into armchair epidemiologists, to use that analogy of what is the R naught of, if I remember before, the viral coefficient being greater than one, what is it that it takes to make something go viral, have an R-naught greater than one?
Right. So the difference between R-naught, being below and above is everything, as we said. So the book is an attempt to find that playbook. And with the researcher, I did a lot of digging. I found amazing stories of people who, just slightly under the radar, are doing beautiful things. So it's all forms of generosity, right? It's not just writing a check. It's just simple acts of human kindness that someone notices. And the book is an attempt to extract from them a kind of a playbook. There's lots of elements to it, but I mean, some of the big ones are, one, I mean, you just have to evoke emotion. You know, so much goodness is sort of earnest and impressive, but if you could trigger that, oh my goodness, that human being did that.
That warm, that warmness that's
boom,
deep.
Suddenly that gets shared. Creativity. Some people are able to show insane levels of creativity. If you can do that, that makes all the difference. So my example in the book is, you want to clean up the streets in your neighborhood, so you organize volunteers to come together and do it. Fine, that's nice. You might take pictures, post a video. In Japan, when they did it, they dressed up samurai warriors and used swords to sort of, you know, pick up this trash in the most glorious way. Of course, those videos went viral, and as a result, thousands of other groups formed. Insane creativity. Courage. Deep courage gets noticed. Daryl Davis, an African-American musician, was puzzled why people seemed to hate him, some people, because of the color of his skin. He reached out to the local leader of the Ku Klux Klan to have a meeting. They had a tense meeting.
I thought actually was phenomenal about this story, which you go into in the book, is like that member of the KKK actually didn't know that Daryl was black.
Yeah, that's right. So that
it was like out of a movie.
That was a bit of a bolt out of the blue right when the thing happened. And they, you know, some ice clinked during the meeting and they all leapt to their feet because they thought someone had drawn a gun. Tense. They formed a friendship. Weirdly, they kept meeting. Daryl went to KKK rallies. And eventually, to cut a long story short, his friend left the KKK. Dozens of others did as well. And his story, of course, got picked up by media, CNN. It was spread around the world because you don't see courage like that every day. When you see it, you go, wow. And so, again, think about that. As a result of his courage, Daryl Davis has shown millions of people what it can look like to perform what I think is one of the most important acts of generosity in the age we're in, bridging. Bridging. It's really hard to bridge between people who are divided, but to listen to someone with respect, wow, that can change everything. So that's another huge one. And then there's other things as well, but that points to the playbook exists. We can break out of our normal, oh, I'm so disappointed, I tried really hard and no one paid any attention. Well, try some different things and you never know.
I think one of the things might be helpful is, you know, as I was reading it, living in this area, we're a city with lots of challenges right now, and there's a critical moment of time where generosity is needed. A lot of people are disillusioned. And so what do you tell people who are, you know, walking regularly down the street? You meet somebody who could use some generosity. You talk really in depth about the challenges that we all face in that moment of time where courage is required or decision is. Maybe share a little bit about that.
So all forms of generosity start with just finding a generous mindset. And it's actually the hardest thing. It's not necessarily easy to do. I think it probably starts with by thinking about gratitude and trying to look at the bigger picture. But the first gift of any act of generosity is the gift of attention. And it sounds like a small thing, and in one way it is a small thing. It's hard to do, as we all know, when we're walking to work, say, we're in our own zone, you know, especially a place like San Francisco, when you can be deluged with people who are in need, who need something, and the last thing you want to do is to give them any attention, because, I mean, come on, what is that going to lead to? But everyone can do something different with their generosity mindset. I'm not saying that everyone goes down this route, but I tell stories in the book of people who did. They turned and they looked at someone, and the act of feeling seen is actually, again, that triggers a powerful response in people right there. From that moment, lots of things can happen. In one case in the book, someone decided to offer someone a haircut because they were a hairdresser and they had their stuff with them. And that led to actually a global movement and this whole sort of idea of do something for nothing.
But this is also fantastic because I follow this guy on Instagram. And so maybe take a second to tell people a little bit about
Joshua Coombs. Joshua Coombs. He was walking down the street in, I think it was London, and this happened. He hadn't planned it. But, I mean, sure, the person who got the haircut said, this is great. Nothing like this has happened to me. Felt this sort of dignity and new motivation to figure out a pathway back off the streets. But for Joshua, it was equally meaningful. It was like, holy crap. He blew off other meetings he had planned for that day, and he was really moved by it and decided, I've just got to do this more. And what he had discovered is one of the things that we often don't really know. We kind of know it theoretically, we don't feel it, which is that the act of being generous makes you feel differently about yourself. It gives a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, probably a sense of happiness. The link between generosity and happiness is real. And so that can get a wheel turning. Now, it's not everyone's act of generosity to try and solve the homeless problem in a place like this. But the move from just thinking about your own stuff to, wait a sec, what if I looked out and imagined, you know, there's a cause I could research, or there's someone who I know actually who I could give something to. That shift is huge. And it really, I think one of the key things that's really hit home to me so hard, even since writing this book, is how asymmetric generosity is. We forget this. We're tempted to think a gift is a gift. Someone has it, they give it up, they've lost it, someone else gets it. Zero sum. It is almost always not zero sum. I mean, in the case of money, it's kind of obvious. A rich person can give an amount of money. That may cost them actually nothing, but it can be life transformative for the person who gets it in some circumstances. But every other form of generosity is like that. The generosity of sharing a connection, sharing your network with someone. It can take you 10 minutes and a sort of carefully thought out email to three of your friends. You need to know this person. May I introduce you to them? For that person, it can change their life. And so this is the magic of generosity generally, that every single form of it actually is anchored in, it's easier for the giver. The giver loses less than the receiver receives. And actually, when all said and done, the giver loses nothing because they are surprised by the happiness and sense they get. So
you actually have a quote from Thomas Jefferson in the book, which I think is one of my favorite.
Right. So he famously says, he was there speaking about the gift of knowledge or the gift of ideas. He who lights his candle at mine obtains the light, and I don't lose my light. So that's a complicated quote, because actually when you give away knowledge, you do lose something. You lose the right to exclusive exploitation of that knowledge. But still, the point is, in many, many, many cases, giving knowledge costs you very little, and the gain is amazing. Sal Khan started putting videos on the internet. It took him an hour to put a video up. Now, those videos are seen by like millions of people. I mean, the asymmetry is mind-boggling. So in a world of generosity, if we could make a world where generosity was more embedded, all boats rise. This is a huge deal. It is massively, massively positive sum.
Well, you actually ran an experiment. You put your money where your mouth is, so to speak, on this. And so maybe tell us about the $2 million experiment you ran.
Right. So we had a crazy donor couple in the tech community who made some money, and they wanted to be generous, pass it on. But they wanted to learn something as well. And so we brainstormed with them what we called the mystery experiment. So I recruited a bunch of people on Twitter who didn't know what they were signing up for, and picked 200 of them. And they kind of received what was really the ultimate scam email. You know, congratulations. We would like to wire $10,000 into your PayPal account. No strings attached. Okay. So it took a bit of persuading. But when they took the money, I mean, what would you predict they would do with it? There was one string attached. The string attached was that they had to spend it in 3 months, and they had to tell us what they spent it on. But it was literally, it was explicit. You can spend it on anything. 2/3 of that money was spent generously. This is on average across all recipients, all 7 countries, different income levels. 2/3. It is not what most economists would predict, I think. And I had the chance to speak to people afterwards and say, why did you do that? And they said, they almost all gave versions of this. It was like, if I'd won the money in a lottery, it would have been different. But because this money was donated to me, because it was given to me as an act of generosity, I felt seen, and I felt I had to pass that forward. I wanted other people to be seen the way I had. you know, that was a beautiful feeling. I wanted to pass it on. And so the shocker here is that biology is our friend. Biology is truly our friend. There are two big instincts. There's the initial desire for, just to be generous in the first place, intense desire to be empathetic to people. Empathy is it's a crude emotion. It doesn't always work out in the right way, but it is powerful. And when you see someone suffering, you want to help them. That is weird for an evolved animal that's supposed to be looking after their own interests. We actually, in many circumstances, we will even risk our lives to help someone else. So generosity is there deep inside every single human, except a few psychopaths. And so is the desire to respond to generosity. Mm-hmm. And by the way, there's another instinct which is really interesting, which is not just to respond to generosity. If you see someone out there being generous to someone else, that itself prompts generosity in someone. So I'm going, wait a sec. These newly confirmed facts about the science of generosity, combine that with the fact that we're in a connected world where suddenly we can reach not just our small community, but literally thousands or millions of people. And we can share videos. You can see a video of someone doing something kind, and that can have an effect. That surely means that there's a possibility here for something absolutely amazing to be true in this world. Why aren't we just sharing acts of kindness? It's in everyone's interest to do it, and feeling good about each other and feeling better about each other. And why, instead of that, is the opposite happening? And we're sharing reasons to distrust and dislike and hate each other and talking ourselves down. What's that about? But at least the potential for the upside, when you put those pieces together, is truly astonishing.
Chris, as we're talking about this, you know, this is something that I thought through in the book, and you raise it as a question, what's the role of generosity versus government and public policy? And, you know, the way you're talking about this biological instinct we have to look out for each other, you think about these questions of public policy, like universal basic income, similar experiments like the one you just described. The largest stimulus programs ever for the United States have been put forth in the Biden administration. And you see this similar conversations in other countries. And that seems to land differently when it's government versus a person. So as you've gone on this journey, how should we think about the different roles we play as individuals, systems like religious organizations, philanthropic, larger entities, city, state, federal governments, etc.?
Obviously, what governments do is incredibly important to pretty much everything. It's not a topic I actually know very much about. My lens on the world is as a media entrepreneur and someone who's interested in what individuals can do. So I don't discuss in great depth what could happen in policy. I do think that there is an incredibly important role in philanthropy to be the risk takers and to show governments what might be possible. There's so many great examples of philanthropists who've tried something, and when they've proven it, it has unlocked two orders of magnitude more resources from the government because there is the working model. So
yeah, we used to call it scout and scale. Hey, each of these towns or individuals is an experiment. We just now need to figure out what the commonality is to accelerate it.
Right. So the lens of the book is what we as individuals can do as opposed to what we can get angry about of the government not doing or whatever. I do wonder myself, I didn't write about this in the book, whether in some future, governments could actually give generosity a chance to work its magic and could say to people, for example, if I was Joe Biden, I would be tempted to invite to the White House 200 of America's richest people and say to them, it's amazing what you've achieved. I would like to give you the chance to be heroes. We happen to have 200 really challenging and important infrastructure projects that will make a huge difference collectively to America. And it would just be amazing if some of you would sign up to support these, as opposed to, we're going to raise your taxes 20%. And there's a different psychology here that just possibly would make a difference. And I don't think this experiment has probably been tried. I personally think it's an experiment worth doing at some point. But in this connected era, I believe passionately it's a world where we need to reframe what generosity can be. And I think if we do, all kinds of other things, possibilities may come to the fore.
Right. Well, you know, as you talk about that, you know, I think you and I both sort of grew up in that, like that techno-optimist moment, myself being on the builder side of these technologies, you're also building on the media side. And we're like, hey, this is going to be great. Mm. And then the systems, we see this version that we have now where one side isn't just opposed to another side. They want utter destruction of the other party or the other entity. And you can take this local politics, global, national, you can take it to religious areas around the world now. And so what I'm really interested in in this question is, how do we actually use generosity to do what you described earlier, to bring ourselves to bridge that divide? Like, what can we do so that we're not falling into this trap?
Yeah. I think it's incredibly hard and incredibly important. So one set of answers to that is trying to imagine how we would change what happens on social media, because arguably that is where a lot of this is bred. My diagnosis of the main thing that has gone wrong with social media is this, is that when social media platforms were designed, we were naive about human nature. We assumed that humans are basically good if you optimize systems for human choice. If you look at what humans click on and what they like and so forth, and then amplify that, that's going to be great. It's a win-win-win. The system will get better. You'll have people's attention so you can sell them ads and, you know, all the rest of it, and it'll be great. And they forgot, I think, that people aren't... User choice is not just a thing. User choice depends on which user you're talking about. We are complex people. At a minimum, we are a system one, to use Danny Kahneman's language in his brilliant book, Thinking Fast and Slow. You know, we're system one, fast thinkers, instinctive, our lizard brains, for want of a better term. And a little bit of system two, which is our reflective selves that are actually the we that we actually want to be. Our reflective selves will be the people who on our deathbeds will look back and say, am I proud of the life I lived? But our system one selves, our lizard brains, are in charge when we're doom scrolling, when most of our engagement with social media. And so what, unfortunately, tragically, social media algorithms have done is they've been optimized to turn us all into lizards, and they have been successful at it. This is not a good thing. This is really not a good thing. And so I think the cure is for both the platforms themselves and for us to figure out how to empower our reflective selves over those lizard brains. And I think it's a solvable task.
You're one of the top five conveners in the world with the TED platform. And so you talk a little bit about this book, but maybe, you know, because we're here in the center of Silicon Valley, where these platforms are being created, the leaders are here, you know these leaders. What has that been like as you try to get them, you know, your chapter is take back the internet. How do we take back the internet?
So it's hard. And a lot of people out there would say it's going to be impossible because the business models lock in the current mode. Those lizard brains may be unfortunately unpleasant in many circumstances, but boy, are they powerful, and they hold people on for hours and hours, and the ads depend on that, and so you're never going to persuade them otherwise. I may be naive here, but I actually don't think that that is an unsolvable problem. First of all, the people who create value at all the social media platforms are creative people who do not want to work for a company that is doing evil. Now, I actually think there is intense debate going on in these companies, and has been for the last several years, on how to fix this problem. I could be wrong, but I think that even the senior leadership, even though it's unquestionably true that the commercial incentives slow any change down, I think if it was really clear that there was door A, make 40% more money, door B, avoid destroying the public good, I think people would take door B. And there actually have been instances where some of the leaders have willingly taken down the value of their companies to try to, for example, appoint huge numbers of content moderators and all the rest of it. So I think it's worth trying to intensify that debate. there's a lot of good things that are happening under the surface. So if you take the most, arguably the most toxic platform of all, X, mm-hmm. formerly Twitter, I mean, Elon Musk said something important when he first took it over, which was that his goal was to optimize unregretted user minutes. Now, regret is a function of the reflective mind. So that was the right thing to say. That was the right thing to say. Whether they are actually measuring that and taking it seriously, living up to it, you could definitely debate. There are some signs.
I don't know if we have to debate it, because it's pretty, I mean, when the guy's making anti-Semitic comments online, but you control the platform, yeah. There's almost this challenge that even if you have a generous spirit, you're kind of drawing the lines. You get to draw the rule set,
yeah.
which is it's a tension.
It is a tension. I get there is a legit amount of disgust and anger against what's actually happened. Whether Elon himself is anti-Semitic, he obviously has taken great pains to
he's deny done a lot.
That
That's
and is trying to, arguably is trying to fight that. There's one especially promising development at X, which is worth paying attention to, which is community notes. That has been dialed up strongly in the last year. So that is an attempt by Twitter X users themselves to identify when something is factually inaccurate or just really bad. And so often, like quite quickly, posts that are wrong will get context added. I think that's constructive. But look, the main point I'm making is that if they were serious about looking for unregretted user minutes, measure it and do what it takes to correct that. That means you've got to somehow ask questions of people's reflective selves after their experience of being on X for a bit. Do you have regrets? Some people have regrets. My regret might be something that Elon posted, you know. But measure that. And if you can tackle that, that's one thing to do. I think the bigger thing I'd say just to people listening or watching is we've actually got a lot of power. We can train the algorithms to do things differently than they do by who you follow, who you like. You know, just stop it coming out of doom scrolling mode and saying, wait a sec, who can I find on here who is actually spreading great stuff, insight, wonder, delight, hilarity, kindness, generosity? Those people assuredly exist. I actually kind of crazily started a search today on X to create 5 awards for people who are doing some of those things to try to amplify them. And the good stuff is there if you look for it. And I don't think it's like we've got to shift from 10% to 90%. I think we probably have to shift from about 45% to 55%, and a lot changes. But I don't think it's impossible.
Well, it's interesting because even like Instagram, you know, the original team of Instagram kind of put in a buffer when you hit sort of we're spending too much time. As you point out, TikTok has been forced to do this also with the regulations in China. But then, of course, when TikTok was acquired by Facebook, then it becomes the infinite scroll and keeps going. And so, you know, as you see these developments taking place with these platforms or X kind of going the way Twitter going the way it is, are you still a techno-optimist or pessimist?
So optimism, in my definition, is not a feeling or a prediction. I don't feel good about where things are. And I don't predict that things will get better. What I am is determined to try to find a pathway where they might. If you can shine, look, the future is literally not written. No one knows how this will play out. But if you can find a pathway and get agreement among good-thinking people, that is promising, more people will walk down that pathway, and at least there's a shot. So I think for me that the key phrase is determined optimism. We have to be determined optimists. Craig Venter said an amazing thing on the TED stage once, I thought, where he was asked, do you think the optimists are right or the pessimists? He said, I don't know. But I've observed this. It's the optimists who get things done.
Interesting. That's very profound. Yeah. It's a very Craig statement.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, featuring a discussion with Chris Anderson and DJ Patil. I'm Gloria Duffy. Please stay in touch with Commonwealth Club, our events, the travel program, and more. by subscribing to our email newsletter at commonwealthclub.org/email. Now, back to our program.